Rita Hayworth and Shawshank Redemption, Cassette 3.
Anyhow, the day of that conversation about Mexico and about Mr. Peter Stevens, that was the day I began to believe that Andy had some idea of doing a disappearing act. I hoped to God he would be careful if he did, and still I wouldn't have bet money on his chances of succeeding. Warden Norton, you see, was watching Andy with a special close eye. Andy wasn't just another deadhead with a number to Norton. They had a working relationship, you might say. Also, Andy had brains, and he had heart. Norton was determined to use the one and crush the other. As there are honest politicians on the outside, ones who stay bought, there are honest prison guards. And if you're a good judge of character, and if you have some loot to spread around, I suppose it's possible that you could buy enough look the other way to make a break. I'm not the man to tell you such a thing has never been done. But Andy Dufresne wasn't the man who could do it, because, as I've said, Norton was watching. Andy knew it, and the screws knew it, too. Nobody was going to nominate Andy for the Inside Out program, not as long as Warden Norton was evaluating the nominations, and Andy was not the kind of man to try a casual Sidney Doog type of escape. If I had been him, the thought of that key would have tormented me endlessly. I would have been lucky to get 2 hours' worth of honest shut-eye a night. Buxton was less than 30 miles from Shawshank, so near and yet so far. I still thought his best chance was to engage a lawyer and try for the retrial, anything to get out from under Norton's thumb. Maybe Tommy Williams could be shut up by nothing more than a cushy furlough program, but I wasn't entirely sure. Maybe a good old Mississippi hard-ass lawyer could crack him. And maybe that lawyer wouldn't even have to work that hard. Williams had honestly liked Andy. Every now and then I'd bring these points up to Andy. He would only smile, his eyes far away, and say he was thinking about it. Apparently, he'd been thinking about a lot of other things as well. In 1975, Andy Dufresne escaped from Shawshank. He hasn't been recaptured, and I don't think he ever will be. In fact, I don't think Andy Dufresne even exists anymore. But I think there's a man down in Zihuatanejo, Mexico, named Peter Stevens, probably running a very new small hotel in this year of our Lord, 1976. I'll tell you what I know and what I think. That's about all I can do, isn't it? On March 12, 1975, the cell doors in cell block 5 opened at 6:30 a.m., as they do every morning around here except Sunday. And as they do every day except Sunday, the inmates of those cells stepped forward into the corridor and formed two lines as the cell doors slammed shut behind them. They walked up to the main cell block gate, where they were counted off by two guards before being sent on down to the cafeteria for a breakfast of oatmeal, scrambled eggs, and fatty bacon. All of this went according to routine until the count at the cell block gate. There should have been 27. Instead, there were 26. After a call to the captain of the guard, cell block 5 was allowed to go to breakfast. The captain of the guards, a not-half-bad fellow named Richard Gagnar, and his assistant, a jolly prick named Dave Burks, came down to cell block 5 right away. Gagnar reopened the cell doors, and he and Burks went down the corridor together, dragging their sticks over the bars, their guns out. In a case like that, what you usually have is someone who has been taken sick in the night, so sick he can't even step out of his cell in the morning. More rarely, someone has died or committed suicide. But this time they found a mystery instead of a sick man or a dead man. They found no man at all. There were 14 cells in cell block 5, 7 to a side, all fairly neat. Restriction of visiting privileges is the penalty for a sloppy cell at Shawshank, and all very empty. Gagnier's first assumption was that there had been a miscount, or a practical joke. So instead of going off to work after breakfast, the inmates of cell block 5 were sent back to their cells, joking and happy. Any break in the routine was always welcome. Cell doors opened, prisoners stepped in, cell doors closed, some clown shouting, "I want my lawyer, I want my lawyer, you guys run this place just like a frigging prison." Burks, "Shut up in there or I'll rank you." The clown, "I rank your wife, Berkey." Ganya. Shut up, all of you. You'll spend a day in there. He and Burks went up the line again, counting noses. They didn't have to go far. Who belongs in this cell? Ganya asked the right-side night guard. Andrew Dufresne, the right-side answered. And that was all it took. Everything stopped being routine right then. The balloon went up. In all the prison movies I've ever seen, this wailing horn goes off when there's been a break. That never happens at Shawshank. The first thing Ganya did was to get in touch with the warden. The second thing was to get a search of the prison going. The third was to alert the state police in Scarborough to the possibility of a breakout. That was the routine. It didn't call for them to search the suspected escapee's cell, and so no one did. Not then. Why would they? It was a case of what you see is what you get. It was a small square room, bars on the windows and bars on the sliding door. There was a toilet and an empty cot, some pretty rocks on the windowsill. And the poster, of course. It was Linda Ronstadt by then. The poster was right over his bunk. There had been a poster there in that exact same place for 26 years. And when someone... It was Warden Norton himself, as it turned out, poetic justice if there ever was any, looked behind it. They got one hell of a shock. But that didn't happen until 6:30 that night, almost 12 hours after Andy had been reported missing, probably 20 hours after he had actually made his escape. Norton hit the roof. I have it on good authority. Chester, the trustee, who was waxing the hall floor in the admin wing that day. He didn't have to polish any key plates with his ear that day. He said you could hear the warden clear down to records and files as he chewed on Rich Gagne's ass. What do you mean you're satisfied he's not on the prison grounds? What does that mean? It means you didn't find him. You better find him. You better, because I want him. Do you hear me? I want him. Gagne said something. Didn't happen on your shift, that's what you say. So far as I can tell, no one knows when it happened, or how, or if it really did. Now, I want him in my office by 3 o'clock this afternoon, or some heads are going to roll. I can promise you that, and I always keep my promises. Something else from Ganya, something that seemed to provoke Norton to even greater rage. No? Then look at this. Look at this. You recognize it? Last night's tally for cell block 5. Every prisoner accounted for. Dufresne was locked up last night at 9, and it is impossible for him to be gone now. It is impossible now you find him. But at 3 that afternoon, Andy was still among the missing. Norton himself stormed down to cell block 5 a few hours later, where the rest of us had been locked up all of that day. Had we been questioned? We had spent most of that long day being questioned by harried screws who were feeling the breath of the dragon on the backs of their necks. We all said the same thing. We had seen nothing, heard nothing. And so far as I know, we were all telling the truth. I know that I was. All we could say was Andy had indeed been in his cell at the time of the lock-in, and it lights out an hour later. One wit suggested that Andy had poured himself out through the keyhole. The suggestion earned the guy 4 days in solitary. They were uptight. So Norton came down, stalked down, glaring at us with blue eyes nearly hot enough to strike sparks from the tempered steel bars of our cages. He looked at us as if he believed we were all in on it. Probably he did believe it. He went into Andy's cell and looked around. It was just as Andy had left it, the sheets on his bunk turned back, but without looking slept in. Rocks on the windowsill, but not all of them. The ones he liked best he took with him. Rocks, Norton hissed, and swept them off the window ledge with a clatter. Ganya, who was now on overtime, winced, but said nothing. Norton's eyes fell on the Linda Ronstadt poster. Linda was looking back over her shoulder, her hands tucked into the back pockets of a very tight pair of fawn-colored slacks. She was wearing a halter, and she had a deep California tan. It must have offended the hell out of Norton's Baptist sensibilities, that poster. Watching him glare at it, I remembered what Andy had once said about feeling he could almost step through the picture and be with the girl. In a very real way, that was exactly what he did, as Norton was only seconds from discovering. "Wretched thing!" he grunted and ripped the poster from the wall with a single swipe of his hand. and revealed the gaping, crumbled hole in the concrete behind it. Gagne wouldn't go in. Norton ordered him. God, they must have heard Norton ordering Rich Gagne to go in there all over the prison. And Gagne just refused him, point blank. "I'll have your job for this," Norton screamed. He was as hysterical as a woman having a hot flash. He had utterly blown his cool. His neck had turned a rich, dark red, and two veins stood out throbbing on his forehead. "You can count on it, you Frenchman. I'll have your job, and I'll see to it that you never get another one in any prison system in New England." Gagne silently held out his service pistol to Norton, but first he'd had enough. He was then 2 hours overtime, going on three, and he just had enough. It was as if Andy's defection from our happy little family had driven Norton right over the edge of some private irrationality that had been there for a long time. Certainly he was crazy that night. I don't know what that private irrationality might have been, of course, but I do know that there were 26 cons listening to Norton's little dust-up with Rich Gagne that evening, as the last of the light faded from a dull late winter sky. All of us hard-timers and long-line riders who had seen the administrators come and go, the hard-asses and the candy-asses alike, and we all knew that Warden Samuel Norton had just passed what the engineers like to call the breaking strain. And by God, it almost seemed to me that somewhere I could hear Andy Dufresne laughing. Norton finally got a skinny drink of water on the night shift to go into the hole that had been behind Andy's poster of Linda Ronstadt. The skinny guard's name was Rory Tremont, and he was not exactly a ball of fire in the brains department. Maybe he thought he was going to win a Bronze Star or something. As it turned out, he was fortunate that Norton got someone of Andy's approximate height and build to go in there. If they had sent a big-assed fella, as most prison guards seem to be, the guy would have stuck in there as sure as God made green grass, and might be there still. Tremont went in with a nylon filament rope, which someone had found in the trunk of his car, tied around his waist, and a big 6-battery flashlight in one hand. By then, Gagne, who had changed his mind about quitting and who seemed to be the only one there still able to think clearly, had dug out a set of blueprints. I knew well enough what they showed him, a wall which looked in cross-section like a sandwich. The entire wall was 10 feet thick. The inner and outer sections were each about 4 feet thick. In the center was 2 feet of pipe space, and you want to believe that was the meat of the thing, in more ways than one. Tremont's voice came out of the hole, sounding hollow and dead. "Something smells awful in here, Warden." "Never mind that. Keep going." Tremont's lower legs disappeared into the hole. A moment later, his feet were gone, too. His light flashed dimly back and forth. "Warden, it smells pretty damn bad." "Never mind, I said," Norton cried. Dolorously, Tremont's voice floated back. "Smells like shit. Oh, God, that's what it is. It's shit. Oh, my God, let me out of here. I'm going to blow my groceries. Oh, shit, it's shit. Oh, my God." And then came the unmistakable sound of Rory Tremont losing his last couple of meals. Well, that was it for me. I couldn't help myself. The whole day, hell no, the last 30 years, all came up on me at once, and I started laughing fit to split, a laugh such as I'd never had since I was a free man, the kind of laugh I never expected to have inside these gray walls, and oh, dear God, didn't it feel good. "Get that man out of here," Warden Norton was screaming, and I was laughing so hard I didn't know if he meant me or Tremont. I just went on laughing and kicking my feet and holding onto my belly. I couldn't have stopped if Norton had threatened to shoot me dead bang on the spot. "Get him out!" Well, friends and neighbors, I was the one who went. Straight down to solitary, and there I stayed for 15 days. A long shot. But every now and then I'd think about the poor old, not-too-bright, Rory Tremont bellowing, "Oh, shit, it's shit!" And then I'd think about Andy Dufresne heading south in his own car, dressed in a nice suit, and I'd just have to laugh. I did that 15 days in solitary, practically standing on my head. Maybe because half of me was with Andy Dufresne. Andy Dufresne, who had waded in shit and came out clean on the other side. Andy Dufresne, headed for the Pacific. I heard the rest of what went on that night from half a dozen sources. There wasn't all that much anyway. I guess that Rory Tremont decided he didn't have much left to lose after he had lost his lunch and dinner, because he did go on. There was no danger of falling down the pipe shaft between the inner and outer segments of the cell block wall. It was so narrow that Tremont actually had to wedge himself down. He said later that he could only take half breaths, and that he knew what it would be like to be buried alive. What he found at the bottom of the shaft was a master sewer pipe which served the 14 toilets in cell block 5, a porcelain pipe that had been laid 33 years before. It had been broken into. Beside the jagged hole in the pipe, Tremont found Andy's rock hammer. Andy had gotten free, but it hadn't been easy. The pipe was even narrower than the shaft Tremont had just descended. Rory Tremont didn't go in, and so far as I know, no one else did either. It must have been damn near unspeakable. A rat jumped out of the pipe as Tremont was examining the hole in the rock hammer, and he swore later that it was nearly as big as a cocker spaniel pup. He went back up the crawl space to Andy's cell like a monkey on a stick. Andy had gone into that pipe. Maybe he knew that it emptied into a stream 500 yards beyond the prison on the marshy western side. I think he did. The prison blueprints were around, and Andy would have found a way to look at them. He was a methodical cuss. He would have known, or found out, that the sewer pipe running out of cell block 5 was the last one in Shawshank not hooked into the new waste treatment plant. And he would have known it was do it by mid-1975, or do it never, because in August they were going to switch us over to the new waste treatment plant, too. 500 yards. The length of 5 football fields. Just shy of half a mile. He crawled that distance, maybe with one of those small pen lights in his hand, maybe with nothing but a couple of books of matches. He crawled through foulness that I either can't imagine or don't want to imagine. Maybe the rats scattered in front of him, or maybe they went for him, the way such animals sometimes will when they've had a chance to grow bold in the dark. He must have had just enough clearance at the shoulders to keep moving, and he probably had to shove himself through the places where the lengths of pipe were joined. If it had been me, the claustrophobia would have driven me mad a dozen times over. But he did it. At the far end of the pipe, they found a set of muddy footprints leading out of the sluggish, polluted creek the pipe fed into. 2 miles from there, a search party found his prison uniform. That was a day later. The story broke big in the papers, as you might guess, but no one within a 15-mile radius of the prison stepped forward to report a stolen car, stolen clothes, or a naked man in the moonlight. There was not so much as a barking dog in a farmyard. He came out of the sewer pipe, and he disappeared like smoke. But I am betting he disappeared in the direction of Buxton. 3 months after that memorable day, Warden Norton resigned. He was a broken man, it gives me great pleasure to report. The spring was gone from his step. On his last day, he shuffled out, with his head down, like an old con shuffling down to the infirmary for his codeine pills. It was Gagne who took over, and to Norton that must have seemed like the unkindest cut of all. For all I know, Sam Norton is down there in Elliott now, attending services at the Baptist Church every Sunday and wondering how the hell Andy Dufresne ever could have gotten the better of him. I could have told him. The answer to the question is simplicity itself. Some have got it, Sam, and some don't, and never will. That's what I know. Now I'm going to tell you what I think. I may have it wrong on some of the specifics, but I'd be willing to bet my watch and chain that I've got the general outline down pretty well. Because with Andy being the sort of man that he was, there's only one or two ways that it could have been. And every now and then, when I think it out, I think of Normandin, that half-crazy Indian. Nice fella, Norbiton had said after selling with Andy for 8 months. I was glad to go, me. Bad draft in that cell. All the time cold. He don't let nobody touch his things. That's okay. Nice man. Never made fun. But big draft. Poor, crazy Norbiton. He knew more than all the rest of us, and he knew it sooner. And it was 8 long months before Andy could get him out of there and have the cell to himself again. If it hadn't been for the 8 months Norbiton had spent with him after Warden Norton first came in, I do believe that Andy would have been free before Nixon resigned. I believe now that it began in 1949. Way back then. Not with the rock hammer, but with the Rita Hayworth poster. I told you how nervous he seemed when he asked for that, nervous and filled with suppressed excitement. At the time, I thought it was just embarrassment, that Andy was the sort of guy who'd never want someone else to know that he had feet of clay and wanted a woman, especially if it was a fantasy woman. But I think now that I was wrong. I think now that Andy's excitement came from something else altogether. What was responsible for the hole that Warden Norton eventually found behind the poster of a girl that hadn't even been born when that photo of Rita Hayworth was taken? Andy Dufresne's perseverance and hard work. Yeah, I don't take any of that away from him. But there were two other elements in the equation. A lot of luck and WPA concrete. You don't need me to explain the luck, I guess. The WPA concrete I checked out for myself. I invested some time and a couple of stamps and wrote first to the University of Maine History Department and then to a fellow whose address they were able to give me. This fellow had been foreman of the WPA project that built the Shawshank Max Security Wing. The wing, which contained cell blocks 3, 4, and 5, was built in the years 1934 to 1937. Now, most people don't think of cement and concrete as technological developments, the way we think of cars and oil furnaces and rocket ships, but they really are. There was no modern cement until 1870 or so, and no modern concrete until after the turn of the century. Mixing concrete is as delicate a business as making bread. You can get it too watery, or not watery enough. You can get the sand mix too thick or too thin, and the same is true of the gravel mix. And back in 1934, the science of mixing this stuff was a lot less sophisticated than it is today. The walls of cell block 5 were solid enough, but they weren't exactly dry and toasty. As a matter of fact, they were and are pretty damn dank. After a long wet spell, they would sweat and sometimes even drip. Cracks had a way of appearing, some an inch deep. They were routinely mortared over. Now here comes Andy Dufresne into cell block 5. He's a man who graduated from the University of Maine School of Business, but he's also a man who took 2 or 3 geology courses along the way. Geology had, in fact, become his chief hobby. I imagine it appealed to his patient, meticulous nature. A 10,000-year ice age here, 1 million years of mountain building there, plates of bedrock grinding against each other deep under the earth's skin over the millennia. Pressure. Andy told me once that all of geology is the study of pressure. And time, of course. He had time to study those walls, plenty of time. When the cell door slams and the lights go out, there's nothing else to look at. First-timers usually have a hard time adjusting to the confinement of prison life. They get screw fever. Sometimes they have to be hauled down to the infirmary and sedated a couple of times before they get on the beam. It's not unusual to hear some new member of our happy little family banging on the bars of his cell and screaming to be let out. And before the cries have gone on for long, the chant starts up along the cell block, "Fresh fish! Hey, little fishy, fresh fish, fresh fish, got fresh fish today." Andy didn't flip out like that when he came to the shank in 1948, but that's not to say he didn't feel many of the same things. He may have come close to madness, some do, and some go sailing right over the edge. Old life blown away in the wink of an eye, indeterminate nightmare stretching out ahead, a long season in hell. So what did he do, I ask you? He searched almost desperately for something to divert his restless mind. Oh, there are all sorts of ways to divert yourself, even in prison. It seems like the human mind is full of an infinite number of possibilities when it comes to diversion. I told you about the sculptor and his three ages of Jesus. There were coin collectors who were always losing their collections to thieves, stamp collectors, one fellow who had postcards from 35 different countries, and let me tell you, he would have turned out your lights if he'd caught you diddling with his postcards. Andy got interested in rocks and the walls of his cell. I think that his initial intention might have been to do no more than to carve his initials into the wall where the poster of Rita Hayworth would soon be hanging. His initials, or maybe a few lines from some poem. Instead, what he found was that interestingly weak concrete. Maybe he started to carve his initials and a big chunk of the wall just fell out. I can see him, lying there on his bunk, looking at that broken chunk of concrete, turning it over in his hands. Never mind the wreck of your whole life. Never mind that you got railroaded into this place by a whole trainload of bad luck. Let's forget all that and look at this piece of concrete. Some months further along, he might have decided it would be fun to see how much of that wall he could take out. But you can't just start digging into your wall. And then when the weekly inspection, or one of the surprise inspections that are always turning up interesting caches of booze, drugs, dirty pictures, and weapons comes around, say to the guard, "This? Just excavating a little hole in my cell wall, not to worry, my good man." No, he couldn't have that. So he came to me and asked if I could get him a Rita Hayworth poster, not a little one, but a big one. And, of course, he had the rock hammer. I remember thinking when I got him that gadget back in 48 that it would take a man 600 years to burrow through the wall with it. True enough. But Andy only had to go through half the wall, and even with the soft concrete, it took him 2 rock hammers and 27 years to do it. Of course, he lost most of one of those years to Normandin, and he could only work at night, preferably late at night, when almost everybody is asleep, including the guards who worked the night shift. But I suspect the thing which slowed him down the most was getting rid of the wall as he took it out. He could muffle the sound of his work by wrapping the head of his hammer in rock-polishing cloth, but what to do with the pulverized concrete and the occasional chunks that came out whole? I think he must have broken up the chunks into pebbles and... I remember the Sunday after I'd gotten him the rock hammer. I remember watching him walk across the exercise yard, his face puffy from his latest go-round with the sisters. I saw him stoop, pick up a pebble, and it disappeared up his sleeve. That inside sleeve pocket is an old prison trick, up your sleeve or just inside the cuff of your pants. And I have another memory, very strong, but unfocused, maybe something I saw more than once. This memory is of Andy Dufresne walking across the exercise yard on a hot summer day when the air was utterly still. Still. Yeah. Except for the little breeze that seemed to be blowing sand around Andy Dufresne's feet. So maybe he had a couple of cheetahs in his pants below the knees. You loaded the cheetahs up with fill and then just strolled around, your hands in your pockets. And when you felt safe and unobserved, you gave the pockets a little twitch. The pockets, of course, are attached by string or strong thread to the cheetahs. The fill goes cascading out of your pants legs as you walk. The World War II POWs who were trying to tunnel out used the dodge. The years went past, and Andy brought his wall out to the exercise yard, cupful by cupful. He played the game with administrator after administrator, and they thought it was because he wanted to keep the library growing. I have no doubt that was part of it, but the main thing Andy wanted was to keep Cell 14 in Cell Block 5 a single occupancy. I doubt if he had any real plans or hopes of breaking out, at least not at first. He probably assumed the wall was 10 feet of solid concrete, and that if he succeeded in boring all the way through it, he'd come out 30 feet over the exercise yard. But, like I say, I don't think he was worried over much about breaking through. His assumption would have run this way. I'm only making a foot of progress every 7 years or so. Therefore, it would take me 70 years to break through. That would make me 101 years old. Here's a second assumption I would have made had I been Andy. That eventually I'd be caught, and get a lot of solitary time, not to mention a very large black mark on my record. After all, there was the regular weekly inspection and a surprise toss which usually came at night every second week or so. He must have decided that things couldn't go on for long. Sooner or later, some screw was going to peek behind Rita Hayworth just to make sure Andy didn't have a sharpened spoon handle or some marijuana reefers scotch-taped to the wall. And his response to that second assumption must have been, to hell with it. Maybe he even made a game out of it. How far in can I get before they find out? Prison is a goddamn boring place, and the chance of being surprised by an unscheduled inspection in the middle of the night while he had his poster unstuck probably added some spice to his life during the early years. And I do believe it would have been impossible for him to get away with it just on dumb luck. Not for 27 years. Nevertheless, I have to believe that for the first 2 years, until mid-May of 1950, when he helped Byron Hadley get around the tax on his windfall inheritance, that's exactly what he did get by on. Or maybe he had something more than dumb luck going for him, even back then. He had money, and he might have been slipping someone a little squeeze every week to take it easy on him. Most guards would go along with that if the price is right. It's money in their pockets, and the prisoner gets to keep his whack-off pictures or his tailor-made cigarettes.